Blog Talk Radio.
Is an audio production of Speculist Media. You can find us online at worldtransformed.com. This program explores a convergence of technologies and emerging possibilities which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transition in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And the World Transformed is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. We're not here so much as the future as we are to encourage you to think about your future and to consider what may be the biggest transformation of them all, the one that will occur in your life, in your world, the one that begins with recognizing and acting on the vast possibilities that are unfolding before you and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does the amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my blogger, co-futurist and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing good. Just got word from the chat room that you're intermittently cutting out. Not sure what we can do about that at this point, but
I've just made an adjustment on my headset, which may or may not make a difference. Let me know if the problem persists.
Okay, we will.
I'll dial in, I guess would be the
answer. It is persisting. You're still cutting out intermittently. I am sorry, Phil, but that would be a little distracting.
We had trouble with me getting in earlier, so I'll tell you what I'm going to do is I'm going to switch phones. I don't usually have as good a luck with them as with the landline, but I'll have to give that a try here tonight. So just stand by, and I'll log back in.
Okay, sounds good.
All right.
All right. Well, anyway, the program tonight is going to be us, Phil and I, talking about Eric Drexler's new book, and Radical Abundance is the name of the book, and we're pretty excited about it. It's going to be a good program tonight. All right. Let's see what we got, Phil. Now.
Hello.
How are you? Okay.
All right. Well, do you want me to repeat the whole spiel? Basically, this is a show about the future, is what I was trying to get at. Am I still breaking up, or am I okay?
Yeah. You sound great now, Phil. Thank you.
Okay, cool. How are you, Stephen?
Doing great. Doing much better now that I can actually hear my co-host. Yes, I'm doing awesome. I hope you're doing great tonight as well.
Oh, I'm super fantastic. I'm glad we cleared our glitch out of the way, a minor one as they go, so we can move ahead with the. So, you know, as I was ending the spiel there, it occurred to me that today is the day has a lot of resonance for some of our recent shows, because it seems like we've had a lot of shows that we've put off that we said we were going to do, and then one thing or another came up, and we've been talking about this one for at least 3 weeks. So
yeah.
I'm excited that today is the day we're finally talking about Radical Abundance by K. Eric Drexler. It's a book that we've been looking forward to reading for more than a year. I've been looking forward to reading it ever since we heard that it was coming out, and been looking forward to talking about it on the show ever since it became available. So tonight is the night, I guess, is another way of saying that we finally get into that. Before we do, anything interesting going on that you wanted to share with us this evening before we start the serious discussion of atomically precise manufacturing?
I think this time let's just dive in, and we can the small talk can wait, right, Phil? I mean, we can
Yeah, well, because we've got the very small to talk about here tonight. So there it is. If we can be allowed that transition. You know, this is Eric Drexler's, I think, third book that he is the main author, the sole author of on this particular subject. He wrote Engines of Creation back in the 80s, and he wrote Nanosystems. I believe he has co-authored at least one of the books related to the topic, and of course he's written other things as well. But this is kind of his follow-up to Nanosystems, and really his follow-up to Engines of Creation, talking about nanotechnology, a term which he has now replaced in this book with atomically precise manufacturing, APM, and that's the term we'll be using to talk about this evening. And I think it's kind of interesting and kind of important to understand where Drexler is coming from to talk about why he made that change. Why did he go from nanotechnology to APM? And so I'm gonna read just a little snippet from the book. This is Eric Drexler from the book Radical Abundance on the subject of enthusiasm. Some instructions to the two of us, Stephen, for how we are to comport ourselves this evening. Okay, so get ready.
Okay. Yeah. Let's get this out of the way early so we can act accordingly.
Yes, this is what Eric advises. He says, there's something that I feel I must say to some of my readers, and I hope that they will understand a somewhat counterintuitive message and take it to heart. If you find these ideas about prospective technologies compelling, convincing, and exciting, if you imagine vistas far beyond any I've outlined or see solutions to urgent global problems and feel the urge to share the full measure of your excitement, then please lie down until the urge passes. In the world as it is, this kind of excitement triggers a negative response, and for reasons that usually make sense, almost all grand ideas proclaimed by excited proponents turn out to be wrong and are generally discounted without consideration. If you want to make a positive difference, please help to keep fundamentals first, help to correct mistaken ideas, and join the conversation without shouting. All right. Well,
that's first off, let me tell you what the music is tonight, and we'll go ahead and roll it and call it a night.
Exactly. I guess that's
what's in the show. Because, I mean,
it's the wind out of our sails.
That's right. Exactly. That's hilarious. I, you know, what do you think, Phil? Is it even possible to talk about these things without, you know, finding the ideas compelling and interesting? And, you know, I don't know.
I think I understand why he says this. You know, he has been through a long process of having to defend and explain his ideas. Drexler has gone through over the years, and he's had to deal not only with his ideas, which he gladly and readily defends, but all too often has to deflect things that aren't really things he wrote about in Engines of Creation or ever wrote about that have kind of come along for the ride with nanotechnology that he has then made the spokesman for, even if he didn't originally talk about them. So, you know, he thinks his ideas have been overhyped, that they've been mischaracterized, that they've been added to, misunderstood, and redefined out from under it. And he wants to get the idea across that this thing is what he says, you know, he wants to talk about what he wants to talk about, not what everybody else seems to always want to talk about. And I think that's what he's getting at. And he feels that the kind of enthusiasm that I think we are just all about here on The World Transformed is not necessarily helpful to that process. So we're going to take him at his word. We're gonna be duly chastised about being so gosh darn excited about APM, and we'll spend just a few minutes going through what it is according to Drexler. And I think if we do that, we can then step back a little and talk about some other things he says and see if curbing one's enthusiasm really is the right approach, and two, if it's even possible to do that. You know, I personally, my enthusiasm can only be curbed on certain subjects for so long. And, you know, this is an hour show. That's kind of pushing it for me. But we know, I mean, even last week, our guest on a completely different subject issued some skepticism about Drexlerian nanotechnology, and we've heard it from other guests. And it's a kind of a common theme these days. I think it's kind of the in thing in H-plus circles, transhumanist circles, to be highly skeptical of Drexler. So let's talk about what he says APM is and see what cause there is for skepticism around that, and what cause actually ultimately for enthusiasm there is around that. So first off, I've got, he ends the book, he makes about 11 points about these are the things you should keep in mind about APM. This is what it is, this is what it's not. I've distilled that list down to about five of them, and let's just kind of work through those. The first one is item one, APM, atomically precise manufacturing, is a kind of manufacturing. Okay, so he uses the book to outline, that's what he's talking about. He's talking about manufacturing. And he doesn't want to talk about applications. In fact, in a section of the book called The Products of APM, he makes a point of saying we're not going to talk about consumer products at all. Now, that limit we will observe for now, but we will not observe for the entire program because, I think to talk about manufacturing and then not talk about the products, but say we can talk about the products but not talk about the ones people use, is overly restrictive. But note that, right? Item one,
right.
It's manufacturing, okay? It's not other things that you've heard about nanotechnology. It's manufacturing. Okay, so number two, APM systems are factories, yet quite different from the factories of today. And he goes into a description of what an APM factory is that boils down to you plug an APM system into the wall, and it works like a printer, okay? It's like a 3D printer, but much more sophisticated because you're going to have small, simple machines, as he explains it, that bring molecules together to build nanoscale parts, and then large machines that bring small parts together to build larger parts, until finally you've got full-size components and then ultimately full-size products coming out. Working essentially the way a factory does today, because most factories don't have people in them doing an awful lot of this stuff. There's stuff coming in and there's products coming out the other end. And this is that whole process moves to the desktop or moved to a very small concentrated space. That's what atomically precise manufacturing is. You've got the tiniest machines guiding molecular motion and molecular bonding. And then beyond that, you've got machinery at increasingly larger scale that works pretty much like the machinery that we currently have. So the trick is doing that first molecular step. Right? If we are convinced that atomically precise molecular management can be accomplished around moving molecules around and ultimately creating components can be handed up to the next scale, the rest of it, I think, is plausible. You know, I'm not sure how anyone could really have an argument with very small manufacturing. I don't think anyone could really have an argument with micro manufacturing. It already occurs. The question is, can you get from that first step of bonding molecules and working via molecular motion, cross that threshold into the micro world where things are much, much smaller than they are here, but they still essentially have the same properties. But we'll get into that as we go. The idea to keep in mind is basically it's a factory that works pretty much like factories do in the world today, except for that one first step, which is completely different. It's not magic, but that's the breakthrough. Would you agree, Stephen?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, everything seems like magic until you look closely, I guess. But it's provided that you believe that we can move around molecules and do it in a way that is economically feasible. Then this can be done. I would say that the real trick is making the first APM factory. Once you have the first one, that's I think a key ingredient to making new ones after that. It's you need to be able to work in the very small in order just to create the first APM system. So, And once you got that down, then you know, then I think it rolls out pretty fast after that.
That's exactly right. Within the process, that first step is crucial. And within the implementation of the technology overall, getting the first one out is crucial. But once you have that, once you cross that threshold, and we'll get into how daunting that threshold actually is.
First one will cost trillions, and then after that, it'll be pretty cheap. So.
Exactly, yeah. It doesn't like it goes down to lesser trillions. It goes down to zip. I mean, it drops rapidly. Item four, ATM Technologies. Item three, scaled-down machinery enables remarkable results. This is an important thing to keep in mind, that the smaller the machine, the faster it can work. And as he points out in the book, nanoscale machines can produce many times their own mass per second. We don't think about this, but the time it takes to move and to do things, the smaller you get, the faster those things happen. So there's always this fear that, well, you're just dealing with these incredibly tiny quantities of things. You are, but by the time you're down to the nanoscale, you're moving wicked fast. Actually, he didn't use this analogy in radical abundance, but in Engines of Creation, I think he makes this great comparison between like a bumblebee, a housefly, and a mosquito. And it's about the sound that each of them makes, right? And you know, if you just think of the musical note that each one is producing, right? The bumblebee is giving you this, right? The housefly is giving you this, right? And the mosquito is like way up there. It's giving you this, and he talks in terms of how fast those wings are flapping based on the fact that each one is somewhere in the vicinity of an order of magnitude smaller than the one before it, right? So if you keep shrinking down, the motions go faster and faster and faster and faster. You're able to produce an incredible amount of very small stuff, and it actually keeps pace. The example he gives in there of a car being manufactured in a space about the size of a garage, as you work through the process, you think, well, okay, here in the end, you've got these big components, and they're all coming together, and it's making a car. But think how much longer it must take to make those components that are only half that size, and then half that size, and half that size, and half that size. And he describes these shelves, and you're working your way back, but you never go any farther than half the distance of the first shelf because of the wonderful the fact that all the whole scale of all of it is being cut in half each time. And the truth is, each time you cut the size in half, you cut the amount of time it takes to produce the components in half. So the whole thing actually works remarkably fast, and by starting with atomically precise components at the very bottom, you get atomic precision all the way up.
I don't know if it's a metaphor or if it's exactly the same as what he's talking about, but I know that as components are shrunk on a computer chip, your computer gets faster in part, well, not in part, but because the speed at which electrons move throughout the system, the electricity moves throughout the system, is increased because it's going shorter distances. I don't know if that's analogous to what we're talking about with APM, or if we're talking about almost the exact same thing. But
I think it's pretty close. Yeah, I think we're right on the same track. And in fact, that leads right into item four, which is APM Technologies Parallel Digital Technologies. We're just working with atoms and molecules rather than bits and bytes. And a lot of the proof of concept for APM comes from work that's being done around creating microchips. That this is where atomic precision in manufacturing is already being accomplished to a certain extent. It's one of the areas, and we'll talk about some of the others. But fantastic quote here from the book. He says, like other systems based on digital information, sound systems, and printers, APM-level production technology will enable a box on a desktop to produce a virtually infinite range of products drawn from a digital library. And I would add to that, to your point earlier, including, and probably most importantly, components for building APM systems, right? That's going to be the really cool thing that they produce is the ability to produce more of those machines. Although when you go back to virtually infinite range of products drawn from a digital library, I'm sorry, we get to talk about that, okay? We get to talk about what's in that.
We got to talk about what kind of digital, what sort of things do you put in the digital library? Yeah, it's,
He doesn't have to write about it, but we're going to talk about it anyway.
Yeah, we're definitely.
Yeah. And then item five, and this is, I think, the crux of the book. And I actually wish he had spent more time on this and elucidated this a little bit further. But item five is very important, that there's been surprising progress towards atomically precise manufacturing. And he goes to a great deal of detail to explain one of the reasons people don't see nanotechnology happening is they're looking for it in the wrong places. They're looking for it in research that has been mislabeled nanotechnology by the government and by industry and by others. But that the core process, that crucial first step, that's the tricky one, is actually taking place increasingly in a lot of different areas. He says we've been doing it for 100 years in chemistry, but we're getting better and better at it. That there are great proofs of concept and actually techniques that have been developed around genetic engineering that have almost direct applicability to APM. There's materials processing methods that are being pushed now to the point of atomic precision, and there's work that's being done on building precise patterns on crystals with probes that is moving in that direction. So actually techniques coming from a number of different places that are getting better and better, that aren't being used to produce products. They're not being used in a manufacturing context right now, but each of them actually proves that first step is possible. And I don't know if you saw that video that's been floating around, what's it called, a Boyna's Atom or something like that, that was made by IBM, but basically it's a little animated film using atoms as the pixels.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. I mean, yeah, it's a little cartoon made with atoms that they moved around to make the picture. So, you know, just like any other form of animation, they have these atoms on a background or whatever. They take a picture, they move them slightly, take another picture, and by that made a cartoon, which is just amazing. Being able to move atoms around like that is really a proof of concept of what Drexler's talking about. If they can do that, then just scale it up, man. We got it, you know.
That's his point. To review those five, it's kind of manufacturing. The systems are factories, but different from the factories that we currently have because they're these little desktop self-contained units, and also different because they start with that first step, which is completely different from anything that's done in manufacturing now, which is moving atoms around. The scale of it provides for remarkable results, that it parallels digital technology, and that there's been a lot of progress in this direction over the last few years that has gone largely unrecognized. But to your point, Stephen, you said it exactly right. The fact that we are doing that, we're doing it better, we're doing it all the time, and haven't applied it to manufacturing yet, doesn't mean we can't, and doesn't mean we won't. The fact that we can control the movements of molecules, and we can do atomically precise placement of atoms. I guess atomically of atoms is redundant, but the point is the fact that we can do that in one context suggests that we should be able to do it in another. And to do it in the context of creating components that can then be handed up to the next scale, conceptually, there's no reason in the world why that can't happen. And I think he makes this case pretty compellingly. I mean, I have not been one of those who buys into the skeptical arguments myself all that much anyway, because I think the argument is sound going all the way back to Richard Feynman, and there's plenty of room at the bottom. I think that there's good reason to believe that eventually we will do this, and that the skepticism that we're seeing right now is just the like natural Newtonian reaction to the hype that we had before. For every hype overreaction, there's an equal and opposite skepticism overreaction, and we miss what's really happening twice. In the Paul Saffel's S curve, he talks about the fact that people start to miss out on all the progress that's really being made. And they get very skeptical, and then suddenly the thing shows up. And I think that's probably the phase we're heading into right now with atomically precise manufacturing. And I think that's the source of the skepticism. But it's also exactly the case that Drexler is making here in the book, which is that we're making tremendous progress towards this, and it's going almost completely unheralded because people aren't thinking of it in terms of it being, quote-unquote, nanotechnology. They're just thinking of it as being chemistry or genetic engineering or, you know, advances in each of these other areas. But all of these advances
have potentially have application there. And once they're actually put into the service of doing that, I think we're going to see some remarkable things happen.
You know, I think Drexler is suffering from the fact that there's a potential future ahead where, you know, we realize all of his dreams and then look back and say, you know, it's remarkable how far we've come, but we almost got off on the wrong foot with Drexler's ideas way back when, you know, like as if what he outlined was very much different from what he actually said. I think that's the big issue here, is that he said A, then other people came and added A plus one, and then now everybody interprets A plus one as what he said, which is not true.
I think that's right. And you know, now that we've covered those five points and we've laid out the major argument of the book, I want to actually step back and talk about some of the background passages, background sections of the book that come prior to this, and see if from a practical standpoint, the let's not get too excited about this approach is actually going to work for us. I want to swing it back around to the context that Drexler puts APM into earlier in the book, and there's a chapter called Three Revolutions and a Fourth. And Stephen, I assume you're up to speed on that. Go ahead and talk us through those three revolutions if you want to.
Absolutely. We as mankind have been through some pretty significant technological ages, and he outlines them. The first is the agricultural age. We basically went from a hunter-gatherer society into an actual civilization society where we gathered into cities and began to farm, and that was agriculture. That was followed much later by the industrial age, and then after that by the information age. And he is saying, okay, now the age to follow the information age is the APM age, or the atomically precise manufacturing age. And it's kind of hard to oversell if you're going to say that, Mr. Drexler or Dr. Drexler, if you're going to say that, how in the world can you overhype that? I mean, let's say I'm going to go back in time. I got my TARDIS out. I'm going to travel with Doctor Who back to the hunter gatherers and explain to them what's about to happen with the agricultural age. But don't get too excited about this, guys. You know,
don't oversell it. Okay.
Yeah.
You're gonna have all the food you want, and you never have to worry about getting rained on anymore. And you're gonna actually, I can't even describe most of what you're gonna be doing.
You're gonna love the beer. You're gonna love the beer.
Yeah.
But
it's part of the reason you're making the shift, actually. Yeah.
But
let's not get all worked up like it's any big deal. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that makes the case that deep down, he feels he has to put these disclaimers in. He has to tell people not to get too excited. He has to beg people not to push it off in weird directions. But he knows this is huge. I mean, and he writes it in the first half of the book, in the first like three quarters of the book that it is. And the expectation that we would be able to think it otherwise, I think, is it's not realistic. And I'm not sure it's all that helpful. I think that you want the kind of enthusiasm that we see around the maker movement right now coming into play and backing APM as that technology becomes available. I actually think that the enthusiasm of a forward-looking group of people who want to bring the future about is finally going to be helpful. However many setbacks there have been up to this point, in the long run, once this stuff is coming online, it's going to be exactly what it needs. Now, you know, one of the things that that he talks about that I think is really interesting when he compares those three revolutions, he talks about the fact that there's some common threads running through these revolutions that have come before. Agriculture, he points out, was based on molecular machinery. I never thought about that, but it's true.
It is.
You know,
yeah,
you know, because all life is based on molecular machinery, but with no design. The only design you're able to put in there is very long-term breeding of plants and animals and some of that kind of stuff, but not really able to design the outputs to any great extent. Whereas the Industrial Revolution was based on machines made by design, but obviously you were nowhere near the molecular scale. So you've added the design piece, and I think some other important pieces, the automation piece is a huge part of why that one is so significant. And then you get to the Information Revolution, which he points out is based on digital, on nanoscale devices, but that only process information, not matter. And then finally you come to APM, and it brings everything together. You've got design, you've got molecular machinery, you've got it digitally based, and that's the explosion. I mean, truly, it's the biggest of the four revolutions. It has to be because it's the one that brings all the different components together.
Yeah. And, you know, at some point we might need to have a show on the dangers of that, but I think it's something that we might not even get to tonight. But the potential for abuse of something as powerful as that, it's something we might want to talk about at some point in the near future.
Oh, I think so. Well, it's the danger that follows the human capability curve. Right, that's what you're talking about, right? The fact that once you have a machine on your desktop that can produce anything, you can produce just about anything. And as problematic, go ahead.
You know, it's like the 3D printed guns. You know, I mean, that's,
I was just about to say, yeah.
That's the macro level of problem. Now, what if we can produce things at the atomic level that are potentially much more dangerous? You know that I can do it in my own home. I don't need a huge lab or anything like that. There's some potential for some real harm there. So anyway,
the more people are able to do, let's face it, the more people are able to do, the more harm they're able to do. Right? I mean,
exactly.
The more good they're able to do, but capable means capable, you know.
Exactly. And, you know, it's basically what I've always said, though, Phil, the best defense to technology is to be better at it than the bad guys. And
right.
So, you know, do we try to relinquish this because of the potential of abuse? No. And if we were to do so, that would be much more dangerous than just going forward. So, anyway.
Because it will show up. Someone's going to do
it's
it.
It's going to show up.
And then you're not even
on
ready.
Top of it.
Yeah.
Better to be ahead of the curve than behind it, that's for sure.
Exactly. And Drexler does touch on all that in the chapter on security, as a matter of fact. But you're right. We're probably not going to spend too much time on that tonight. But I think that is worth exploring in the show. In fact, we should probably do a whole show sometime just on Moore's Law for Mad Scientists, right? Just on the whole downside to the growth of the human capability curve, because it's really worth exploring, and it's occurring in so many different dimensions at the same time that we often don't even think about. That we should probably spend some time thinking about that. So I looked at that progression from agriculture through the Industrial Revolution, through the Information Revolution to APM. I kind of came up with my own terms on this because as much as I liked what he had to say about it, I think it you know, he covered all the points, but it missed something crucial, which is that with agriculture, we were kind of working with nature on its terms. With the Industrial Revolution, we sort of invented this replacement version of nature to produce stuff the way nature produces stuff, only on our terms, right?
Right.
Then we reduced one set of outputs to information, just to pure information, and achieved massive productivity as a result. That's the Information Revolution, the third revolution. And then when we reduce all outputs to information. I don't mean reduce them to information that all we're putting out is information. When we reduce the major component we're dealing with in order to get those to get those outputs to information, that's when you get radical productivity. That's when you get radical abundance. It's because you've got this high-end performance coupled to, as he describes it, lower than low-end costs. And, Stephen, you were talking about that before. The first one costs trillions, and after that they're all free, right, if you want them to be. There's no reason why they would be anything other than free. You get this extremely high productivity through nanoscale production. I take that back. There's no reason why eventually they wouldn't be free. You know,
right.
It's entirely possible that the first one you make out of one that costs trillions, you would sell for a billion and so on down. It's just like when you double things. When you start cutting the cost in half, it goes to nothing pretty fast, right? It gets
exactly.
Down to zero.
I think it'll follow a price drop that'll be exponential. In starting with, you know, too expensive for the even the richest of us, almost down to, you know, we all have one, you know, real quick inside of a decade probably.
Yes, much faster than that's occurred with any technology before. Put it that way.
Because it built into the technology is the reason that it will be faster, the price drop.
That's right.
I don't know exactly how to express it better than that, but that's, I think, built into the technology itself is the reason for the price drop, and it'll happen fast.
Yes. So he talks about you get this high end performance that's costing you less than even low end stuff costs today. You get this high productivity through nanoscale production, and you get this incredibly high productivity through, he talks about, this is a quote, collapsing the globe spanning supply chains to just a few links, from raw materials to just about any imaginable product. I mean, that's huge right there. When you go from needing pieces and parts from everywhere all over the world to, you know, be shipped and flown and, you know, sent by train and sent by truck, all to arrive in one place and all those pieces to be put together, to you pour in some stock, you hit the button, and the thing comes out. I mean, that piece alone, it's hard to overstate the significance of. Not only in terms of how huge a difference it makes for productivity and how radically different it will be getting things once you've got that option of getting things, but also of how destructive potentially this can be to the economy. And we'll come to the catastrophic success argument in a minute, but this is a huge driver of the catastrophic success. When all the logistics, not just the labor, but to make things, but all the logistics to move things together, to assemble things, you know, to package them and to get them to, you know, then once again moved out to the shelf and stocked on the shelf, and you know, you think of all the different people's jobs that depend on all those different actions, and it's all suddenly replaced by, you know, you make sure you got enough of that glop powder in your toner cartridge or whatever it is, and you hit print, right?
Well, you know, he compared it to agriculture in a lot of ways, and I'm going to kind of go back to that just one second. You know,
yeah.
An ear of corn in its complexity and in it is much more complex. An ear of corn is much more complex than, say, a bicycle. Okay. You know, it was built by molecular machinery down to the molecules within that ear of corn. Everything has a purpose, and it's the result is that ear of corn. And I can make an ear of corn for you, Phil, in my backyard. You know, all I have
right.
to do is throw out some seed and you know, encourage it in various ways. You know, weed my garden a little bit, put a little fertilizer out. And I've got an extremely complex and you know, on the molecular level, a beautiful machinery has come into play to build for me an ear of corn, which is this incredibly complex thing. On the other hand, a relatively simple bicycle has parts from all over the world manufactured in various parts places, and probably assembled someplace also distant from me, and put on a truck and brought to a local store, which I have to get in my car and go out and pick up. And all of that to create this relatively simple thing by comparison to the ear of corn. What he's talking about is technology with APM, where we build for ourselves complex things that are on par with the complexity of living things, like an ear of corn, but that nature has never thought about making. And we can do it also in our backyard, just like as with the ear of corn. And
Only much faster than you can get an ear of corn.
Yeah, exactly. It just boom. We got it. You know, you got it overnight. If you accept that as your premise, then everything, you know, our entire society, our society is built on, our civilization is built on depending on one another to do various things, right? You know, I mean, I depend on the people that truck in the goods to my local Walmart. I depend on the guy that brings in the gasoline for the local gas station. All of a sudden, all this stuff falls apart when, you know, you have APM, and what does that world even look like once you've got that in full bloom? You know, where what does that world look? You know, I can't say, and it's hard to predict how things would go down, but it would be catastrophic success is how you described it, and I love that phrase, Phil. And
that is the term, absolutely.
I think that is actually Drexler's term, isn't it? I think that's exactly right. It's catastrophic success, and I don't see it going down any other way. If this is possible, if we can have this, then we will have it. Number one, if it's possible, we'll do it. And number two, it's going to change everything in every way.
Right.
So, there you are. I became the fanboy that he warned against. But that's
we can't help it. We're just. We are what we are, damn it. We're fanboy. Here's what
makes that happen. I agree with you completely. You really just put the whole formula together, and the catastrophe and the success are both coming from the same drivers. It's the same. It's all this wonderful stuff that's happening that causes this catastrophe to occur. And when it gets to the chapter on the products of APM, as I mentioned, he doesn't talk about consumer products, but he does talk about industrial equipment, construction, and transportation infrastructure, all making these amazing leaps forward in terms of capability and in terms of slashing the cost to do things. That actually is going to have its own major disruption. Just applying APM, you know, in a sort of a conventional manufacturing sense, right? Just providing all these much better products out into the world is going to have a profound impact. Then on the energy side, he talks about how we're going to have this improved infrastructure, plus we're going to have the ability to push solar as the world's premier energy source. He makes a really good case for enabling really efficient fuel cells to replace liquid fuel for transportation. Remember, we had that great debate a few weeks ago, and we were talking about how long is it before something like the hydrogen fuel cell is as potent and as reliable and good a source of power for a vehicle as liquid fuel is. And Drexler said it's when APM makes it possible to do it that way, and he goes through the argument for why that would be the case. Then you've got this interesting thing happening with raw material. I mean, these are like the world transformed here, 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 and here. How we interact with raw materials changes. For one thing, we don't have this big massive infrastructure to do things anymore, so we're using a lot less of them. Just through the pure ephemeralization that APM represents, then, and this is big too, we get to start doing everything with much less rare, less expensive raw materials. So now we can use hydrogen and carbon and nitrogen and oxygen and aluminum and silicon to do a lot of what's currently done with copper and nickel and cobalt and zinc and tin, et cetera. So when you put all those – go ahead.
What's that?
The mining industry is destroyed by that. I mean,
exactly.
You can if you can take these things that are abundant right here on the surface and do anything you want to with it, why dig for things that are more rare? So
right. First, it's like this huge productive thing. You go, oh, well, we're making the roads better. We're making everything. It sounds good. And then suddenly you start doing it like, well, we're going to pretty much eliminate the oil business. And, we're going to eliminate mining. And, you know, it ultimately works down to we're going to eliminate the manufacture of construction products as a business, because anyone who needs them will be able to make their own. And we're going to eliminate the production of consumer products as a business. He doesn't get into that. But, again, because people will be able to make their own. But before you get to that point where everybody's making everything, and while you've slid down this road where you've killed the oil business and you've killed the you've started taking a big chunk out of the logistics business and retail and those kinds of things, you have a situation that I love this phrase he uses, because he does earlier in the book, he talks about catastrophic success, but when he adds all these things up, he says it's a situation that will be, quote, difficult to digest. And I think that's exactly right. You're going to see so many profound changes at the same time that it's, you know, beyond upsetting to the order of things. And if we don't approach this carefully, what do we get? We get chaos, right? I mean, we're sort of halfway between one state and another, and the one we'd relied on to get us there is suddenly gone. And we don't quite have the one that pulls everything together and makes the previous one unnecessary. That's kind of the nightmare scenario right there. That's the catastrophe side. You look at all the success side and go, boy, that sounds good. That sounds good. That sounds, yeah, we use cheap stuff and we can make our own stuff. And, you know, you add all those up and they sound great. But it's that gap between those two things. If there's not some handoff, some careful handoff between the old world and the new one, we're in for some real hurt.
Well, I think, you know, we're in right now, Phil, we are not, APM is not, creating havoc for us right now. It's not, it's still, you know, far enough away that that's not an issue, but automation is. We're living in a world right now, Phil, where jobs are becoming more scarce, while the capital markets seem to be doing better. It's like we're becoming more productive with fewer and fewer and fewer people actually involved in the workforce. That creates all kinds of problems. You know, I mean, we have as a society are built around the notion that people work, and it seems to do well for us when most adults are gainfully employed somewhere. So. We're right now in the middle of a transition unrelated to APM, but APM is going to be even more profound. So,
the thing is, we've got a vast working class, which doubles as the vast consumer class.
Right.
So the basic structure that pays the workers produces the stuff that the consumers consume. So there's this very tight symbiotic relationship between each of us as an employee and each of us as a vital consuming member of the current economy. And you're right. And as we've talked about numerous times over the last couple of years, the just automation, just the impending arrival of better and better and closer to human level artificial intelligence creates its own catastrophic success.
You don't even need human level AIs for it to be a problem. You just need, because it just needs to be good enough to barely get the job done to outperform people on a dollar basis. You know.
Yep.
These automatic operators are not anywhere nearly as good as a human operator when I call a phone bank, but it doesn't have to be economically much better for the company to use one of those systems. You know, they don't.
Right.
It's one less salary to pay. Benefits and everything else. It's if it's just barely good enough to get the job done, then that's going to be better for the company, and that's the way it comes down. And so, we're seeing just more and more jobs go that way, and not necessarily because we're even being replaced by better things. at this point. You just have to be good enough to, and so that's where we're at right now. Oh well.
Yeah. Now you accelerate that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Take that process and turbocharge it with all the drivers we just talked about. And,
right.
It gets worse. And in fact, when I think about it, when we've talked about this in the past, when we talked about the lights in the tunnel, and we've gone over various scenarios for this, we've always talked about it in terms of automation. I don't think
right.
we've really ever grappled with the fact that automation is only one pillar of it. It's only one leg of the stool, right?
APM is the final step in automation. I mean, once you reach that, I think that's you pretty much you're done. Everything else is automated. You know, everything is automated at that point. You're far past the factory where you know you got a man and a dog that run it. You know, the man to feed the dog to bite the man if he touches the machine.
Yeah, exactly.
You know. You've got it. You know, everyone's got one in their home at that point, and it's a much different world at that point.
So, what do we do?
I don't know. We busy ourselves perhaps with coming up with new designs for these machines to make for us. Maybe that's what we do. At that point, we just become creative, and then share that knowledge with one another, and enjoy the fruits of the machine. I guess that we have.
Yeah, well, if we can get to where we've all got APM, running, providing our own energy and giving us our own stuff, yeah, I'm not worried about what we do. People can do whatever they want, and they will, right? I mean, that'll be a nice world to live in. What do we do now? And one of the things that I think is really interesting is Drexler does not tell us what we should do. He tells us that we need to be ready for this technology and we need to be thinking seriously about it. I think Drexler doesn't say this, but I think that we should start outlining at least scenarios, if not workable strategies, for how we get to the happy other side as quickly as we can. Now, one thing Drexler does talk about is, I should note that he says because there's so many irons in the fire, there's so many switches, so many moving parts that. It's almost impossible to predict. And he says that the one form of future-oriented knowledge that can be robust is knowledge of the scope of uncertainty itself. And I think we were talking about that a few weeks ago. We were talking about the unknown knowns. Just getting a handle on what we don't know is going to happen is dizzying. It's powerful because we don't know. We don't know how this is going to unfold. We don't know what order it's going to unfold in or any of it. But the word that he uses and that I think we've talked about in other contexts recently and I think is going to be kind of one of the watchwords for the pre-singularity 21st century is resilience. He says, we want to make a more resilient world. And I think that we want to make this transition to APM one that is occurring in as resilient a world as we possibly can. So if you've got APM that's doing things that are making communities more resilient, making people more resilient, like making clean water, it's helping people make their own stuff, it's helping people produce their own energy. If those kinds of applications are the ones that are produced as early in the process as possible, or if there are like already projects going to say, hey, as soon as we have APM, let's work on those things, I think that's a big step in the right direction. And I don't know, if there's no government agency. Big corporations are going to step in and say, hey, we've got to make sure that our transition to APM is a smooth one, then people have to start working on this. We need a group like maybe Foresight or something like the Singularity Institute that is just about recognizing that gap and putting the plans in place for how we're going to use APM to protect us from APM until we can enjoy APM, right? If I can put it in those kinds of terms. But that's really what has to happen. We have to step up and recognize that it's coming and somehow make the best of it.
I think the people that will do the best, Phil, are the ones who are the most flexible. If you have the ability to see the world changing around you and just scrap what it is you're doing and jump in to do the next thing. And if you see that that's not working so well, alter it again. Just the people that are able to, move, change on a dime are the ones that will, be able to make this transition the best, I think. And that's a mindset that each of us can cultivate within ourselves. I don't know, none of us. Here's the thing: none of us know how this will come down and in what ways. But just be ready to alter it the way you earn your living, the way you live your life, as these things happen around us.
Exactly, and I think that's that. Drexler would say that that's a flavor of resilience in its own right, isn't it? To not be too invested in the way things have always been and be ready to make that move. And we talked when we were talking just about automation and just in economic terms, we said, well, what are you going to do? Get some ownership of the people who will own everything if you can, right? If you can buy some stock in those companies, that's probably a good step to take. And on this one, it's like, everybody get a 3D printer. Start learning this world, right? Because that is the first step towards this world. And I think the more people know about it and the better prepared they are for it, the better able they're going to be to turn on a dime, as you said.
Sally said something pretty great here in the chat room. She says, instead of preaching skepticism, singularitarians should be running very aggressive scenarios or coming up with very aggressive scenarios to offer solutions to transition. Right now. So I agree completely. You said earlier, Phil, that it seems to be sort of the fad to talk down Drexler and within our own futures communities. I think we'd be much better served to be looking at the most far out possibilities and preparing ourselves mentally for the possibility that might be the way it happens. So
I think, that's ultimately our role, isn't it? I mean, why are we thinking about all this if it's not to get the world ready for this stuff? That's what we pay lip service to saying what we want to do. So, my challenge to anyone who's highly skeptical about this is read the book and then, tell me why this isn't going to happen, because it certainly feels to me like something that is as close to inevitable as any of the big possibilities that we talked about might be. And I just want to say in closing, since we gave it kind of a hard time, I think it's an excellent book. I agree with the arguments made in the book by and large, and we gave Drexler a hard time for pulling his punches, but I think it's a good book and worthy of people's attention. I think it's one that that everyone who's interested in these issues should be reading.
Before I announce the music, I just want to throw this out. This quote, I found it pretty interesting. Vincent van Gogh says, "Great things are done by a series of small things brought together." And I'll let that, if it's okay with you, I'll let that be the last word, Phil.
That is fantastic. And then what is our music tonight?
our music tonight is "The Smallest Things" by After All These Years.
"The Smallest Things" after all these years. All right, that's a perfect name for a song and a perfect band name, actually, for talking about this book. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Thanks, everyone, for being with us. What fun talking about this tonight. We'll be back again next week with an all-new World Transformed. Look forward to having you all with us. And until next time, live to see it.
What I've already learned. today. I got a lot of living.